Have you ever stopped to consider who truly built America? While politicians often claim credit for our nation's prosperity, the real architects of American greatness were everyday inventors and entrepreneurs who transformed ideas into world-changing innovations. Michelle Malkin's Who Built That directly challenges President Obama's infamous You Didn't Build That statement by introducing us to the tinkerpreneurs, largely self-taught capitalists who revolutionized our world through determination, ingenuity, and entrepreneurial spirit. From the immigrant who created the iconic Maglite to the visionaries who harnessed Niagara Falls, these innovators share common traits: mechanical aptitude, stubborn practicality, creative problem-solving, relentless work ethic, and reverence for America's opportunities. Their interconnected stories demonstrate how pursuing individual success creates collective prosperity, a principle that continues to drive American innovation today. The book has resonated with entrepreneurs like Elon Musk, who cited it as inspiration for his own ventures, and serves as a powerful reminder that America's greatness stems not from government direction, but from the unleashed creativity of its people. Tony Maglica, the 83-year-old inventor of the revolutionary Maglite flashlight, embodies the quintessential American dream. Even in his 80s, he works 12-hour days, 6 days a week, in his 450,000-square-foot factory, personally inspecting products and overseeing operations. With his silver hair, mustache, and lab coat with Tony embroidered on it, he personifies the qualities that made his products legendary: tough, durable, and illuminated from within by an unquenchable spirit. Born in Manhattan during the Great Depression to Croatian immigrants, Tony's early life was marked by extraordinary hardship. When his father could barely earn a living, Tony's mother, Tomica, returned with her toddler to the tiny island of Zlarin in Croatia. There, amid the beautiful but impoverished Mediterranean setting, Tony experienced hunger that few Americans can imagine. His resourceful mother would risk her life rowing to the mainland to trade valuables for food, sometimes leaving young Tony alone for days with just a can of flour. During World War II, Tony witnessed the horrors of Axis occupation, hiding in forests during bombings, and once being rounded up by German soldiers for possible execution. Throughout these trials, his mother taught him to work hard and waste nothing. She even pulled out her own gold-filled tooth to trade for food when they were starving. Despite minimal formal education, Tony developed remarkable mechanical skills by taking apart clocks and carving items from wood. In 1950, with communists overtaking Croatia, Tony finally returned to America with $150 and 20 English words. He started at rock bottom, working in a New York sweatshop for 50 cents an hour while teaching himself English from a dictionary. After facing rejection in Colorado due to his accent, he moved to California, where more discrimination awaited. One man wouldn't even shake my hand at Douglas Aircraft. Undeterred, in 1955, he rented a tiny garage in South El Monte and started Maglica Machine Shop with a $1,000 lathe purchased with a $125 down payment. His precision work for aerospace and defense clients built his reputation, but Tony's true breakthrough came when he revolutionized the flashlight industry. Before his innovation, flashlights were flimsy plastic objects with inefficient bulbs. His design featured a push-button switch instead of a slide switch, an adjustable beam that could switch from flood to spotlight, and self-cleaning contacts that improved connection. The torch's three seams are sealed with O-rings for water resistance, creating a virtually indestructible product. Today, at Mag Instruments headquarters, Tony proudly displays testimonials from police officers, firefighters, soldiers, and 9/11 survivors whose lives were saved by his creation. A Texas officer's Maglite stopped a bullet. A firefighter's light survived being crushed by a fire engine. During the 9/11 attacks, trapped workers used Maglites to guide themselves through smoke-filled stairwells. Despite his success, Tony has spent over $100 million battling intellectual property thieves, fiercely defending his patents. At his Ontario, California headquarters, he employs nearly 800 skilled American workers and builds not just flashlights, but many of the machines that make them. He remains committed to American manufacturing despite government regulations that hampered his innovations. Government doesn't innovate. People like me do. Government doesn't create jobs. We do. At 83, Tony hasn't taken a vacation in over a decade, still walks the factory floor daily to ensure quality, and continues supporting law enforcement, military, and disaster relief efforts. As long as I'm alive, he vows, I will never give up. His journey from war-torn Croatia to American manufacturing legend stands as testament to the power of individual determination and the unique opportunity America offers to those willing to work tirelessly for their dreams. Willis Carrier and Irvin Lyle were the pioneering giants who brought air conditioning to the masses, transforming every sector of the American economy, from Hollywood to pharmaceuticals to retail. Their partnership exemplifies how complementary talents, Carrier's scientific genius and Lyle's marketing brilliance, can revolutionize society when combined with entrepreneurial drive. Born in 1876 on a dairy farm in western New York, Willis Carrier showed mechanical aptitude early by assembling farm equipment and creating his own mathematical problems. His mother, Elizabeth, taught him problem-solving by breaking complex issues into simpler parts, a methodology that would later define his approach to engineering challenges. Despite her death when he was 11, Willis carried her pragmatic spirit forward, rising at 5 every morning to help with farm chores before school. At Cornell University, he balanced rigorous academics with work and even invented the first student co-op laundry. Meanwhile, Irvin Lyle excelled as a scholar-athlete at the University of Kentucky before joining Buffalo Forge Company in 1896. Carrier graduated from Cornell in 1901 and joined the same company, where their paths would cross and change American life forever. Their breakthrough came in the sweltering summer of 1902, when Brooklyn's Sackett & Wilhelm's printing plant faced a crisis. Humid air was ruining expensive color print runs by causing paper to warp and colors to bleed. Lyle forwarded this problem to Carrier, who approached it methodically, breaking down the air conditioning challenge into 4 components: temperature, humidity, air purity, and distribution. By July 17, 1902, he had designed the world's first scientific air conditioning system using cold water pipes and ammonia refrigerating machine. Carrier's eureka moment came on a foggy Pittsburgh train platform, where he realized he could dry air by wetting it through a fine water spray. This counterintuitive insight led to his 1906 patent for apparatus for treating air, while Lyle aggressively marketed their innovations, forming the Carrier Air Conditioning Company. Their system soon revolutionized industries from tobacco processing to chocolate making, improving both product quality and worker conditions. Perhaps their most visible triumph came in 1925, when Carrier personally oversaw installation of his groundbreaking centrifugal refrigeration system at Paramount's Rivoli Theater in Times Square. On opening day, as 2,000 skeptical moviegoers filed in with fans fluttering, Carrier and his team anxiously watched from the wings. Gradually, the fans dropped into laps as the cooling system took effect. Paramount founder Adolf Zukor delivered his terse verdict, "Yes, the people are going to like it." This success transformed summer from Hollywood's slowest season into its most profitable. By 1930, Carrier had installed systems in 300 theaters nationwide, enabling the summer blockbuster phenomenon we know today. Beyond entertainment, their innovation saved countless lives. At Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh, the company installed America's first baby incubation system. Their sophisticated air purification system featured centrifugal fans, heating coils, and air washers that removed bacteria while controlling moisture. Later, Carrier provided critical systems for pharmaceutical manufacturing and Dr. Jonas Salk's polio vaccine production. Salk's lab required precision temperature and humidity control, plus stringent air purity to prevent contamination, technological challenges that Carrier's team solved through innovation. Their industrial successes expanded to banks, hotels, department stores, malls, skyscrapers, and transportation. These innovations fundamentally changed not just how businesses operated, but where Americans could comfortably work and live, enabling population growth across the sweltering Sun Belt. When Lyle died in 1942 and Carrier in 1950, they left behind a legacy captured by founding engineer Edward T. Murphy. We had faith and enthusiasm, courage and vision, a superior product, and held steadfastly to a high standard of integrity. What began as a solution to a printing problem became a multi-billion dollar industry that transformed American life. Their story reminds us that innovation often comes not from government planning, but from entrepreneurs solving practical problems with creativity, persistence, and technical brilliance. America's iconic bridges tell an incredible tale of courage and capitalism through three intertwined love stories. Johann, John, Augustus Roebling's love affair with American freedom and engineering greatness, his son, Washington's loyalty to his father's vision, and Washington's wife, Emily Warren Roebling's passionate dedication to her husband and lifelong learning. At the heart of their legacy are revolutionary wire ropes patented by John Roebling, used not only for suspension bridges, but also for elevators, telegraphs, cable cars, and mining operations. Johann August Roebling was born in 1806 in Mühlhausen, Prussia, the youngest and brightest of four children. Growing up in this walled medieval city of Gothic churches, he developed talents in music, drawing, and constructing toy towers. While his father, Polycarp, ran a small tobacco shop with minimal ambition, his enterprising mother, Friederike, sacrificed to send her gifted son to study in Erfurt and Berlin, where he mastered mathematics, architecture, and hydraulics. Despite earning a surveyor's certification and working on military road projects, Roebling grew frustrated with Prussian bureaucracy that rejected his innovative bridge proposals and required endless deliberation. At 25, he faced a pivotal choice: remain a perpetual subordinate or seek freedom for his genius in America. In May 1831, Roebling set sail aboard the August Edward, enduring a 78-day journey to reach a new fatherland free from tyranny. When hemp cables used for hoisting portage cars over the Allegheny Mountains failed catastrophically, killing workers, Roebling recalled reading about wire rope in German journals. Drawing on both European engineering knowledge and American ingenuity, he became the first to manufacture wire rope in the U.S., enlisting his sons, neighbors, and local farmers in Saxonburg to help with production. Roebling secured patent 2720A in 1842 for his wire rope manufacturing method. Though the hemp rope industry vigorously opposed him, even sabotaging his test installation by cutting his cables, Roebling persevered. When Canal Commission President John Butler gave him another chance, Roebling responded with tears, "God is good." His successful Pittsburgh Aqueduct project in 1845 featured seven spans supported by continuous wire cables, something he later told Washington he never would have been allowed to build in Prussia. After relocating to Trenton, New Jersey in 1849, inspiring the city's eventual motto, "Trenton makes, the world takes," Roebling suffered a horrific workplace accident that permanently disfigured his left hand. Despite this setback, he completed four suspension aqueducts by 1850, preparing him for his next milestone, spanning Niagara Falls with the world's first railway suspension bridge. When the Niagara Bridge opened in 1855, Roebling achieved international fame, leading to projects in Kentucky, where he designed the world's longest suspension bridges. In 1866, he won the appointment to build the Brooklyn Bridge, envisioning a magnificent 1,600-foot steel wire suspension bridge with 250-foot neo-Gothic towers. Tragically, in June 1869, while surveying the site, a ferry crushed his foot against pilings. Despite amputation of his toes, he refused anesthesia and proper medical care, instead using hydrotherapy treatments that led to tetanus. After 16 days of agony, Roebling died at age 63, his mind fixed on the bridge plans until the end. Washington Roebling took over the project, but soon developed debilitating caisson disease, decompression sickness, from working in the underwater chambers. This left him bedridden, but he found strength in his extraordinary wife, Emily. "I had a strong tower to lean upon, my wife, a woman of infinite tact and wisest counsel," he later wrote. Emily became far more than his caretaker. She mastered engineering principles, conveyed his instructions to workers, defended him against critics who claimed he was as one dead, and represented the Roebling Enterprise at public functions. When the Brooklyn Bridge was completed in 1883, after a 14-year battle against political wrangling, disease, and bureaucracy, Emily was given the honor of being the first to cross. The Roebling story demonstrates how individual vision, family loyalty, and entrepreneurial spirit combined to create infrastructure that transformed American commerce and daily life. Their bridges weren't just engineering marvels, they were physical manifestations of American ingenuity and determination that continue to inspire us today. Toilet paper represents an everyday marvel of free market capitalism, a product so mundane we rarely consider its revolutionary impact on public health and hygiene. Speaking metaphorically as toilet paper itself, we can trace its evolution from ancient Chinese imperial mega wipes to modern essential commodity, revealing how individual entrepreneurs, acting in their self-interest without central planning, created something indispensable. Early American papermaking began with William Rittenhouse's 1690 mill near Philadelphia, which partnered with printer William Bradford to supply the colonies. The Rittenhouse dynasty sparked paper mill growth nationwide, with Ben Franklin investing in 18 such mills. Paper manufacturing proved crucial to American independence, with Stephen Crane's Liberty Paper Mill producing currency for the Revolution. By 1810, America boasted 179 paper mills across 17 states, laying the foundation for future paper innovations. The Industrial Revolution transformed papermaking through inventions like the Fourdrinier machine, which produced newsprint quickly and cheaply. As demand outpaced rag supplies, inventors sought new materials, with the Tillman brothers patenting a process for making paper pulp from wood in 1867. Civil War veteran Charles Clark and partners founded Kimberly & Clark in Wisconsin in 1872, strategically located on the Fox River. Their employee, John Hoberg, later started his own mill, creating the soft tissue branded Charmin. Despite the product's practicality, toilet paper faced consumer embarrassment. Seth Wheeler's 1891 patent for perforated toilet paper rolls solved the technical problems of easy sheet separation. The Scott brothers, Thomas, Irvin, and Clarence, ultimately overcame Victorian prudishness through clever marketing, establishing Scott Paper Company in 1879 and perfecting the manufacturing process that remains largely unchanged today. Imagine the marketing challenge. How do you advertise a product people were embarrassed to purchase? The Scott brothers solved this through indirect language and discreet packaging, promoting their product as medicinal paper and highlighting health benefits in women's magazines. Arthur Hoyt Scott, Irvin's son, revolutionized the business by openly associating the family name with their products and creating specialized brands. By 1910, the company's six brands provided 80% of total sales. Arthur also invented and patented the paper towel in 1915, which arrived just in time for the flu pandemic of 1918. The innovation came about serendipitously when a Philadelphia teacher complained about students sharing cloth towels that spread germs. Scott realized his toilet paper could be made thicker and more absorbent, creating a disposable alternative that improved public health. By the late 1930s, Scott paper sales reached $13 million, and in 1995, Kimberly-Clark bought Scott paper for $9.4 billion, a remarkable testament to how solving everyday problems can create enormous value. This humble product's evolution demonstrates how capitalism drives innovation through competition, consumer feedback, and entrepreneurial vision, improving lives in ways government planners could never anticipate. The story of toilet paper reminds us that prosperity often comes not from grandiose government projects, but from entrepreneurs solving basic human needs through persistent innovation and market responsiveness. As economist Leonard Reed noted in his essay iPencil, no central authority could coordinate the complex web of materials, processes, and distribution needed to create even the simplest products. Only the invisible hand of the market could achieve such miracles. The humble bottle cap, invented 122 years ago, revolutionized multiple industries, from beverages to pharmaceuticals. Despite being designed as disposable, this quarter-sized metal top endures as an essential innovation that transformed manufacturing worldwide. William Painter, born in 1838 to a Quaker preacher, grew up poor on a Maryland farm with an ambition to make something. His entrepreneurial journey began in an asparagus patch, where he and his sister earned money harvesting seeds, funds he invested in carpentry tools rather than toys. Though his formal education ended after high school, Painter read voraciously and developed his mechanical skills through apprenticeship. At 17, he began working at a patent leather manufacturing shop where he invented a leather softening machine, only to have it appropriated by his foreman. Rather than becoming bitter, Painter learned the importance of protecting intellectual property, eventually partnering with patent lawyer William C. Wood to safeguard his future inventions. Before his bottle cap breakthrough, Painter patented 85 diverse innovations, including fare boxes, pumps, and an electric railway. A practical workaholic, he would sketch ideas in magazine margins, on shirt cuffs, or chalk designs on his workshop floor, often walking past his Baltimore mansion while lost in inventive thought. His restless energy drove him to continuously improve his inventions, never settling for good enough. Americans have mixed homemade medicinal drinks since the country's founding, with Miss Beecher's 1846 domestic receipt book offering recipes for effervescing fruit drinks like sarsaparillamide. By the late 1880s, the carbonated beverage market was booming, with inventors like John Matthews manufacturing commercial soda fountain equipment. Many familiar brands began as patent medicines. Charles Hyers marketed his root beer at the 1876 Philadelphia Exposition. Pharmacist Charles Alderton created Dr. Pepper around 1885, and John Pemberton introduced Coca-Cola in Atlanta in 1886. William Painter's bottle seal company thrived at the turn of the 19th century, with his son Orrin helping sell seals by weight and delivering groove-making devices to glass manufacturers. The profitable venture coincided perfectly with Edward Libby's relocation of New England Glassworks to Toledo and Michael Owen's revolutionary bottle-making machine. Unsatisfied with the loop seal, Painter conceived a metal corrugated cap lined with cork while on vacation in Narragansett. In 1892, he secured three historic patents for this crown cap, a revolutionary single-use bottle sealing system featuring 21 crimpings, later 24, made of pressed tin plate. This disposable concept was radical for its time. By 1897, Crown Cork and Seal employed 200 people directly, supported 1,000 related jobs, and sold over 280 million combined caps and seals. William Painter passed away in 1906 at Johns Hopkins University. His last words from John 14:6. After Painter's death, Charles McCanus, a cork manufacturing innovator, saved the struggling company. McCanus merged his new process cork company with Crown Cork, introducing Nepro synthetic cork that made caps thinner and cheaper. During Prohibition, Crown shifted to soft drinks, then diversified into everything from mason jar caps to wartime manufacturing. By its 1992 centennial, Crown had become a $9 billion global empire, producing one-fifth of the world's beverage containers. Painter's legacy of patient innovation lives on, exemplifying how small inventions drive economic progress and inspire generations of entrepreneurs. Painter's influence extended beyond his own company. When King Camp Gillette joined Baltimore Bottle Seal Company as a salesman in 1891, Painter advised him to create something disposable. "Why don't you try to think of something like a Crown cork, which, once used, is thrown away, and the customer keeps coming back for more?" This advice stuck like a burr, eventually inspiring Gillette's revolutionary safety razor, another seemingly simple innovation that created billions in value and improved millions of lives. Glass surrounds our daily lives in windows, drinking vessels, jars, windshields, screens, eyeglasses, yet few know the dramatic history behind this ubiquitous material. For centuries, glassblowing was shrouded in secrecy, with masters guarding their techniques like classified information. Venetian rulers imprisoned glassblowers on Murano Island, threatening execution for escape attempts. Later, artisan guilds and unions resisted technological progress to protect their livelihoods. Against this backdrop of resistance, West Virginia coal miner's son Michael Owens and New England industrialist's son Edward Libby revolutionized glass manufacturing, transforming it from ancient handcraft to machine automation. Their partnership created over 200 companies and yielded breakthroughs in light bulbs, bottles, pharmaceutical packaging, auto glass, and fiberglass. During the corrupt reign of Roman Emperor Tiberius Caesar, a glassmaker presented the emperor with a vessel made of flexible glass, vitrum flexae. When the craftsman demonstrated its unbreakable nature by throwing it to the floor and repairing the small dent with a hammer, Tiberius asked if anyone else knew of this breakthrough. Upon learning he was the first, Tiberius ordered the inventor beheaded, fearing the innovation would make gold as cheap as mud. This tyrannical response exemplifies how disruptive innovation threatened economic status quo. In the 13th century, Venice's Great Council transformed the island of Murano into a detention facility for glassmakers. After banning the export of glassmaking ingredients and destroying mainland furnaces, the government forcibly relocated all glassmakers to Murano in 1291. While provided with resources for their craft, these artisans faced death if they revealed secrets or attempted escape. For three centuries, this isolation preserved Venice's glass monopoly. In colonial America, glass manufacturing became a symbol of independence. After the British Parliament enacted the Townshend Acts targeting glass with import duties, colonial leaders organized boycotts of British goods while promoting domestic industries. The Founding Fathers actively encouraged manufacturing. Franklin befriended glass factory owner Caspar Wistar. Jefferson courted glassmakers, and Gallatin invested in a Pennsylvania glasshouse. Edward Libby kept his struggling company afloat through artistic innovation and marketing savvy. He turned a failed batch of amber glass into the popular Amberina line, licensing it to other factories and selling inventory to Louis Tiffany. Meanwhile, Michael Owens, despite his union background, sought advancement beyond his station. When labor troubles threatened Libby's Massachusetts operation, Libby relocated to Toledo, Ohio, recruiting workers, including Owens. The American Flint Glass Workers Union operated under the principle obedience to the majority, seeking tight control over glass manufacturing by enforcing strict rules, limiting apprenticeships, and punishing workers who exceeded production quotas. Facing this wrecking squad, Libby made the bold decision to relocate west or face certain ruin. Libby relocated to Toledo, Ohio, incorporating as Libby Glass Company in 1892. The Midwestern city offered land, worker housing, cash incentives, cheap natural gas, high-quality sand deposits, and excellent transportation. Though initially reluctant, several hundred workers followed from East Cambridge. Libby recruited in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he hired Owens despite his union past. Within 3 months, Owens replaced an incompetent supervisor and proved his worth by firing hundreds of underperforming workers. Mike Owens revolutionized glass manufacturing through a series of groundbreaking patents that eliminated skilled labor requirements. His inventions included a mechanical glass blower that replaced lung power with machine-blown air, a semi-automatic device for blowing light bulbs, and machines that ensured unprecedented uniformity in glass products. With Libby providing financial backing and legal protection, Owens formed an industrial R&D team that continuously improved glass technology. Despite union resistance and boycotts, Owens's machines transformed the industry, reducing bottle prices by 25 to 50% while creating new jobs in related manufacturing. By 1923, 94% of all bottles in America were machine-produced. Owens also demonstrated unbreakable laminated glass by dramatically striking it with a paper cutter, showing its potential for automotive safety applications. The ancient dream of unbreakable glass found new life through Owens and Irving Colburn, whose revolutionary flat glass production method allowed glass to be pulled in continuous sheets. The resulting Libby Owens Sheet Glass Company reported profits of $4.2 million within 3 years. Their company later produced the first laminated auto safety glass for Ford's Model A and created thermopane insulated glass used to protect the Declaration of Independence and Constitution. The overwhelming power of Niagara Falls, 600,000 gallons per second cascading down a 13-story waterfall, seemed impossible to harness until George Westinghouse and Nikola Tesla combined their intellectual and entrepreneurial powers. These two visionaries, an industrialist inventor and a scientist engineer, demonstrated the superiority of alternating current electricity, creating revolutionary sparks when their paths crossed. Tesla's eulogy for Westinghouse, who died in 1914, reveals the deep respect between these two titans. Tesla recalled their first meeting in 1888, describing Westinghouse as physically imposing yet refined. A man with tremendous potential energy who breathed deep and with delight the smoky air of his factories. Though gentlemanly in manner, Westinghouse possessed a warrior spirit that transformed him into a giant when confronted with difficulties. By the time they met, Westinghouse had already invented the railway frog, car replacer, and revolutionary air brake system, founded multiple successful companies, and pioneered railroad signals and natural gas distribution technologies. Starting as a boy tinkering in his father's machine shop, through Civil War service to becoming an industrial leader, Westinghouse drove others, but none so hard as himself. After being forced out of his own company, Tesla endured terrible headaches and bitter tears and took a job as a ditch digger for Western Union. Through a foreman, he met investors connected to J.P. Morgan. Tesla captivated them with his Egg of Columbus demonstration, placing a copper egg on a table with electromagnetic coils underneath that created a magnetic force causing the egg to spin until it stood upright. This secured funding for his new Manhattan lab. In May 1888, Tesla secured 7 historic patents on his polyphase induction motor system and delivered a milestone lecture that earned him professional acclaim. The wild man of electronics had finally gained the respect he deserved, though his work to bring AC power to ordinary people was just beginning. George Westinghouse believed in fairly compensating inventors while scrupulously protecting patents. His company had already been conducting cutting-edge AC research before Tesla, employing brilliant minds like William Stanley, who developed the first commercial electrical transformer. For Tesla, partnering with Westinghouse was ideal. He negotiated a generous deal worth up to $1 million, including $2.50 per horsepower royalties on every motor. Tesla spent a year at Westinghouse's Pittsburgh lab, where engineers refined his designs for commercial viability. Though Tesla eventually returned to New York to pursue other inventions like neon lights and the Tesla coil, he rejoined Westinghouse for their triumph at the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, where their AC system powered 172,000 lamps in the White City. The Telluride test proved transformative for American industry. On June 19, 1891, water from the San Miguel River turned the Pelton water wheel, powering Westinghouse's generator to successfully operate the Gold King Mine's ore crushing mill, arguably the first use of AC for industrial use in the United States. The plant required constant vigilance, with spectacular electrical arcs drawing spectators. As problems arose, Westinghouse engineers developed insulators, arresters, and regulators. After years of struggle against litigation, fear-mongering, and alleged industrial sabotage, the Westinghouse Tesla team triumphed at Niagara Falls in summer 1895. They activated massive AC generators, 10 units of 5,000 horsepower each, that would eventually supply power to Buffalo, Tonawanda, Lockport, and beyond. Newspapers marveled at how modern genius had tamed the mighty power of the Great Cataract. The system's success triggered an unexpected industrial migration, as dozens of companies relocated to Niagara for reliable, cheap power. The electrochemical industry flourished there, led by Carborundum Company, Union Carbide, and Pittsburgh Reduction Company, later Alcoa. By 1927, electrochemists would claim that Niagara Falls made Detroit possible, as virtually every automobile component relied on electrochemical processes powered by the Westinghouse Tesla hydroelectric system. When J.P. Morgan tried to destroy Westinghouse through stock manipulation and hostile takeover attempts, Westinghouse refused to cooperate with crony capitalists or pay political bribes. With his company bleeding cash in 1897, Westinghouse explained his dire situation to Tesla, who magnanimously tore up their lucrative royalty agreement worth an estimated $12 million, accepting $216,000 instead to save his friend's company. Despite this sacrifice, Morgan eventually forced Westinghouse from his own company. While Edison and Morgan used capitalism to control others, Tesla and Westinghouse used free market principles to empower the world. Their legacy demonstrates how principled entrepreneurship can transform society through innovation rather than exploitation. The evolution of prosthetic limbs represents a remarkable American innovation story spanning over a century. From the A.A. Marks Company's 19th-century rubber-based artificial limbs to today's microprocessor-controlled smart limbs, this field exemplifies how entrepreneurial spirit transforms adversity into opportunity and improves countless lives. James Edward Hanger, an 18-year-old Confederate soldier who lost his leg to a cannonball, transformed personal tragedy into innovation. After receiving a crude peg leg, he isolated himself for 3 months, emerging with the revolutionary hanger limb made from oak barrel staves, rubber, and metal, featuring hinges at both ankle and knee. His company, founded in 1906, grew into Hanger Orthopedic Group, now a billion-dollar enterprise with thousands of employees across 43 states and Europe. The prosthetics industry relies on innovative suppliers like Bally Ribbon Company, founded in 1923 by Herbert Harries. Originally making decorative ribbons and military decorations, the company evolved to produce advanced composite materials for aerospace, automotive, and medical applications. In the 1970s, they developed biomedical webbing and braided carbon graphite materials crucial for modern artificial limbs. Similarly, Willow Wood Company, founded by double amputee William Edwin Arbogast in 1907, persevered through the Depression and a devastating factory fire to become a leader in prosthetic technology and computer-assisted design systems. Arbogast's personal experience with amputation drove him to create better solutions for others facing similar challenges. Modern prosthetics have evolved from mechanical devices to sophisticated systems controlled by body movements, external motors, and muscle-generated electrical signals. Today's microprocessor-embedded limbs gather mobility data to improve functionality, enabling activities from Olympic running to rumba dancing. Hundreds of American prosthetics companies thrive, many founded by amputees themselves. Bob Rodacy's TRS Inc. produces specialized attachments, while Van Phillips revolutionized the field with his carbon graphite cheetah legs inspired by animal biomechanics. After losing his leg below the knee in a water skiing accident, Phillips was dissatisfied with available options and set out to create something better. His philosophy, "Anything you can think of, you can create," exemplifies the tinkerpreneurial spirit driving prosthetics innovation. Cutting-edge neural interfaces like BrainGate, funded by entrepreneur Jeff Stebbel and MIT professor Hugh Hare's BioM company, which creates powered ankle-foot prosthetics that emulate natural walking, represent the frontier of prosthetic development. After the Boston Marathon bombing, Hare's team helped dancer Adrian Haslett-Davis return to performing, proudly declaring, "In 3.5 seconds, the criminals and cowards took Adrian off the dance floor. In 200 days, we put her back." America's brightest young minds continue creating innovative prosthetic solutions. 16-year-old Catherine Baumkamp invented a pain-free socket using thermal biofeedback to eliminate phantom pain in amputees. MIT student David Senga developed artificial limbs using MRI and 3D printing technology. Eric Ronning designed a 3D printable prosthetic hand while still in college. Even a Girl Scout troop called the Flying Monkeys secured a patent for a low-cost prosthetic hand made from Lego blocks, Velcro, and a pencil grip, costing just $10 to build. The prosthetics industry demonstrates how America's patent system enables innovators to secure protection for their ideas while attracting investment to bring those ideas to market. As these inventors recognize, securing patents is crucial to helping those in need while building sustainable businesses that can continue innovating for generations. This field exemplifies the best of American innovation, combining technical ingenuity with compassionate purpose, driven by entrepreneurs who often experienced firsthand the problems they set out to solve. Their stories remind us that behind every prosthetic device is not just clever engineering, but human determination to overcome adversity and help others do the same.